Erin turned her head aside to spit out what looked like a wad of phlegm. Then she nodded to Jolie, who raised the baby to her face and blew gently into its mouth. The baby just lay there, head back, beads of blood and foam on its bald head. Jolie blew again, and a miracle happened. The tiny chest heaved. The blue eyes popped sightlessly open. He began to wail. Celia Frode started the applause, and the others joined in, except for Elaine, who had retreated to where she was earlier, her arms once again clasping her midsection. The baby's cries were constant now, its hands made tiny fists.
"That's my baby," Tiffany said and raised her arms. "My baby is crying. Give him to me."
Jolie tied off the umbilical cord with a rubber band and wrapped the baby in the first thing that came to hand, a waitress's apron someone had grabbed from a coat hook. She passed the wailing bundle to Tiffany, who looked into his face, laughed, and kissed one gummy cheek. "Where are those towels?" Erin demanded. "Get them now."
"They won't be too warm yet," Kitty said.
"Get them." The towels were brought, and Mary lined the Budweiser cooler with them. While she did, Lila saw more blood gushing from between Tiffany's legs. A lot of blood. Pints, maybe.
"Is that normal?" someone asked.
"Perfectly." Erin's voice was firm and sure, confidence personified. "Absolutely no problem here." That was when Lila began to suspect that Tiffany was probably going to die. "But someone bring me more towels." Jolie Surratt moved to take the baby from his mother and put him in the makeshift Budweiser bassinet. Erin shook her head. "Let her hold him a little longer." That was when Lila knew for sure. 7. Sundown in what had once been the town of Dueling and was now our place. Lila was sitting on the front stoop of the house on St. George Street, with a stapled sheaf of paper in her hands when Janice Coates came up the walk. When Janice sat down next to her, Lila caught a scent of juniper. From a pocket inside her quilted vest, the ex-warden removed the source, a pint bottle of Shenley's gin. She held it out to Lila. Lila shook her head.
"Retained placenta," Janice said. "That's what Erin told me. No way to scrape it out, at least not in time to stop the bleeding. And none of that drug they use."
"Pitocin," Lila said. "I had it when Jared was born." They sat quiet for a while, watching the light drain from what had been a very long day. At last Janice said,
"I thought you might like some help cleaning out her stuff."
"Already done. Shan't have much."
"None of us do. Which is sort of a relief, don't you think?
We learned a poem in school. Something about getting and spending, laying waste to all our powers. Keats, maybe." Lila, who had learned the same poem, knew it was Wordsworth, but said nothing. Janice returned the bottle to the pocket it had come from and brought out a relatively clean handkerchief. She used it to wipe first one of Lila's cheeks, then the other, an action that brought back painfully sweet memories of Lila's mother, who had done the same thing on the many occasions when her daughter, a self-confessed tomboy, had taken a tumble from her bike or her skateboard. "I found this in the dresser where she was keeping her baby things," Lila said, handing Janice the thin pile of pages. "It was under some nightshirts and booties." On the front, Tiffany had pasted a picture of a laughing, perfectly permed mommy holding up a laughing baby in a shaft of golden sunlight. Janice was pretty sure it had been clipped from a Gerber baby food ad in an old women's magazine, maybe Good Housekeeping. Below it, Tiffany had lettered, "Andrew Jones, Book for a Good Life." "She knew it was a boy," Lila said. "I don't know how she knew, but she did."
"Magda told her. Some old wives' tale about carrying high."
"She must have been working on this for quite a while, and I never saw her at it." Lila wondered if Tiffany had been embarrassed. "Look at the first page.
That's what started the waterworks.
Janice opened the little homemade book. Lila leaned close to her, and they read it together.
10 Rules for Good Living.
1. Be kind to others, and they will be kind to you.
2. Do not use drugs for fun, ever.
3. If you are wrong, apologize.
4. God sees what you do wrong, but he is kind and will forgive.
5. Do not tell lies, as that becomes a habit.
6. Never whip a horse.
7.
Your body is your temple, so do not smoke.
8.
Do not cheat. Give everyone a square shake.
9. Be careful of the friends you choose. I was not.
10. Remember, your mother will always love you, and you will be okay.
It was the last one that really got me, Lila said. It still does. Give me that bottle. I guess I need a nip after all. Janice handed it over. Lila swallowed, grimaced, and handed it back. How's the baby? Okay? Considering he was born 6 weeks shy of term and wearing his umbilical cord for a necklace, he's doing very well, Janice said. Thank God we had Aaron and Jolie along, or we would have lost them both. He's with Linda Bear and Linda's baby. Linda quit nursing Alex a little while ago, but as soon as she heard Andy crying, her milk came right back in, so she says. Meanwhile, we've got another tragedy on our hands. As if Tiffany wasn't enough for one day, Lila thought, and tried to put her game face on.
Tell me.
Gerda Holden, oldest of the 4 Holden girls, she's disappeared. Which almost certainly meant something mortal had happened to her in that other world. They all accepted this as a fact now.
How's Clara taking it?
About as you'd expect, Janice replied. She's half out of her mind. She and all the girls have been experiencing that weird vertigo for the last week or so. So someone's moving them around. Janice shrugged.
Maybe.
Probably. Whatever it is, Clara's afraid another of her girls is going to blip out of existence at any moment. Maybe all 3 of them. I'd be afraid, too.
She began flipping through the Andrew Jones book for a good life. Every page was filled with an expansion of the 10 rules.
Should we talk about the tree? Lila asked.
Janice considered, then shook her head.
Maybe tomorrow. Tonight I just want to sleep.
Lila, who wasn't sure she could sleep, took Janice's hand and squeezed it.
8. Nana had asked her mother if she could sleep over with Molly at Mrs. Ransom's house, and Elaine gave her permission after ascertaining that it would be all right with the old lady.
Of course, Mrs. Ransom said. Molly and I love Nana.
That was good enough for the former Elaine Geary, who was for once glad to have her little girl out of the house. Nana was her dear one, her jewel, a rare point of agreement with her estranged husband, and one that had kept the marriage together longer than it might have survived otherwise. But this evening, Elaine had an important errand to run, one that was more for Nana than it was for her, for all the women of dueling, really. Some of them, Lila Norcross, for instance, might not understand that now, but they would later. If, that was, she decided to go through with it. The golf carts they'd taken on the expedition to that weird tree in the woods were all neatly parked in the lot behind what was left of the municipal building. One good thing you could say for women, she thought, one of many things, was that they usually put things away when they were done with them. Men were different. They left their possessions scattered hell to breakfast. How many times had she told Frank to put his dirty clothes in the hamper? Wasn't it enough that she washed them and ironed them without having to pick them up as well? And how many times did she still find them in the bathroom outside the shower, or littered across the bedroom floor? And could he be bothered to rinse a glass or wash a dish after a late-night snack? No. It was as if dishes and glasses became invisible once their purpose had been served. The fact that her husband kept his office immaculate and his animal cages spotless made such thoughtless behavior more irritating. Small things, you would say, and who could disagree? They were. But over the course of years, those things became a domestic version of an old Chinese torture she'd read about in a Time Life book that she'd pulled out of a donation box at Goodwill. The Death of a Thousand Cuts, it was called. Frank's bad temper had only been the worst and deepest of those cuts. Oh, sometimes there was a present, or a soft kiss on the back of the neck, or a dinner out with candlelight. But those things were just frosting on a stale and hard-to-chew cake. The cake of marriage. She was not prepared to say every man was the same, but the majority were, because the instincts came with the package. With the penis. A man's home was his castle, so the saying went, and etched into the XY chromosome was a deep belief that every man was a king and every woman his serving maid. The keys were still in the carts. Of course they were. There might be an occasional case of petty pilfering in our place, but there had been no real theft. That was one of the nice things about it. There were many nice things, but not everyone could be content with those things. Take all the whining and whinging that went on at the meetings, for instance. Nana had been at some of those meetings. She didn't think Elaine knew, but Elaine did. A good mother monitors her child and knows when she is being infected by bad companions with bad ideas. 2 days ago, it had been Molly at their house, and the two girls had a wonderful time, first playing outside, hopscotch and jump rope, then inside, redecorating the large dollhouse Elaine had felt justified in liberating from the dueling mercantile, then outside again until the sun went down. They had eaten a huge supper, after which Molly had walked the 2 blocks back to her house in the gloaming, by herself. And why could she do that? Because in this world there were no predators, no pedophiles. A happy day. And that was why Elaine was so surprised, and a bit fearful, why not admit it, when she had paused outside her daughter's door on the way to bed and heard Nana crying. Elaine chose a golf cart, turned the key, and towed the little round accelerator pedal. She rolled soundlessly out of the lot and down Main Street, past the dead streetlights and dark storefronts. 2 miles out of town, she reached a neat white building with 2 useless gas pumps out front. The sign on the roof proclaimed it the Dueling Country Living Store. The owner, Kabir Patel, was gone, of course, as were his 3 well-mannered, in public at least, sons. His wife had been visiting her family in India when the aurora struck, and was presumably cocooned in Mumbai or Lucknow or one of those other places. Mr. Patel had sold a bit of everything. It was the only way to compete with the supermarket, but most of it was gone now. The liquor had disappeared first, of course. Women liked to drink, and who taught them to enjoy it? Other women? Rarely. Without pausing to look in the darkened store, Elaine drove her golf cart around to the back. Here was a long metal annex with a sign out front reading Country Living Store, Auto Supply Shop, come here first and save. Mr. Patel had kept it neat. She would give him points for that. Elaine's father had done small engine repair to supplement his income as a plumber, in Clarksburg, this had been, and the 2 sheds out back where he worked had been dotted with cast-off parts, bald tires, and any number of derelict mowers and rototillers. An eyesore, Elaine's mother had complained. It pays for your Fridays at the beauty salon, replied the king of the castle, and so the mess had remained. Elaine needed to put her whole weight against one of the doors before it would move on its dirty track, but eventually she got it to slide 4 or 5 feet, and that was all she needed. "What's the matter, sweetie?" she had asked her crying daughter, before she'd known that damn tree existed, when she'd thought her child's tears were the only problem she had, and that they would end as quickly as a spring shower. "Does your tummy hurt from supper?" "No," Nana said. "And you don't need to call it my tummy, Mom. I'm not 5. That exasperated tone was new and set Elaine back on her heels a bit, but she continued to stroke Nana's hair. "What is it, then?" Nana's lips had tightened, trembled, and then she had burst.
I miss Daddy. I miss Billy. He held my hand sometimes when we walked to school, and that was nice. He was nice, but mostly I miss Daddy. I want this vacation to be over. I want to go back home.
Instead of stopping, as spring showers did, her weeping had become a storm. When Elaine tried to stroke her cheek, Nana knocked her hand away and sat up in bed with her hair wild and staticky around her face. In that moment, Elaine saw Frank in her. She saw him so clearly it was scary.
"Don't you remember how he shouted at us?" Elaine asked. "And the time he punched the wall? That was awful, wasn't it?"
"He shouted at you," Nana shouted. "At you, because you always wanted him to do something, or get something, or be something different. I don't know, but he never shouted at me."
"He pulled your shirt, though," Elaine said.
Her disquiet deepened into something like horror. Had she thought Nana had forgotten Frank, relegated him to the junk heap along with her invisible friend, Mrs. Humpty Dump?
"It was your favorite, too."
"Because he was afraid of the man with the car, the one who ran over the cat. He was taking care of me.
Remember when he yelled at your teacher? Remember how embarrassed you were?"
"I don't care. I want him."
"Nana, that's enough. You've made your
I want my daddy."
"You need to close your eyes and go to sleep and have sweet
I want my daddy."
Elaine had left the room, closing the door gently behind her. What an effort it had been not to descend to the child's level and slam it. Even now, standing in Mr. Patel's oil-smelling shed, she would not admit how close she had come to shouting at her daughter. It wasn't Nana's strident tone, so unlike her usual soft and tentative voice. It wasn't even the physical resemblance to Frank, which she could usually overlook. It was how much she sounded like him as she made her unreasonable and unfulfillable demands. It was almost as if Frank Geary had reached across from the other side of whatever gulf separated that violent old world from this new one and possessed her child. Nana had seemed her old self the next day, but Elaine had been unable to stop thinking about the tears heard through the door and the way Nana knocked away the hand that had meant only to comfort, and that ugly, yelling voice that came from Nana's child's mouth. "I want my daddy." Nor was that all. She had been holding hands with ugly little Billy Beeson from down the block. She missed her little boyfriend, who probably would have enjoyed taking her behind a bush so they could play doctor. It was even easy to imagine Nana and the scabrous Billy at 16 making out in the back of his father's club cab, French kissing her and auditioning her for the position of first cook and bottle washer in his shitty little castle. "Forget about drawing pictures, Nana. Get out in the kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. Fold my clothes, haul my ashes, then I'll burp and roll over and go to sleep." Elaine had brought a crank flashlight, which she now shone on the interior of the auto annex, which had been left alone. With no fuel to run Dueling's autos, there was no need for fan belts and spark plugs. So what she was looking for might be here. Plenty of that stuff had been stored in her father's workshop, and the oily smell in this one was just the same, bringing back with startling vividness memories of the pigtailed girl she'd been, but not with nostalgia, oh no. Handing her father parts and tools as he called for them, stupidly happy when he thanked her, cringing if he scolded her for being slow or grabbing the wrong thing. Because she had wanted to please him. He was her daddy, big and strong, and she wanted to please him in all things. This world was ever so much better than the old man-driven one. No one yelled at her here, and no one yelled at Nana. No one treated them like second-class citizens. This was a world where a little girl could walk home by herself, even after dark, and feel safe. A world where a little girl's talent could grow along with her hips and breasts. No one would nip it in the bud. Nana didn't understand that, and she wasn't alone. If you didn't think so, all you had to do was listen in at one of those stupid meetings. "I think it's a way out," Lila had said as the women stood in the tall grass looking at that weird tree. And, oh, God, if she was right. Elaine walked deeper into the auto supply shed, training the flashlight beam on the floor because the floor was concrete, and concrete kept things cool. And there, in the far corner, was what she had been hoping for. 3 5-gallon cans with their pour tops screwed down tight. They were plain metal, unmarked, but there was a thick red rubber band girdling one of them, and blue bands round the other two. Her father had marked his tins of kerosene in exactly the same way. "I think it's a way out. A way back. If we want it." Some of them undoubtedly would. The meeting women who couldn't understand what a good thing they had here. What a fine thing. What a safe thing. These were the ones so socialized to generations of servitude that they would eagerly rush back into their chains. The ones from the prison would, counterintuitively, probably be the first to want to go home to the old world, and right back into the pokey from which they'd been released. So many of these childish creatures were unable or unwilling to realize that there was nearly always some unindicted male co-conspirator behind their incarceration. Some man for whom they'd degraded themselves. In her years as a volunteer, Elaine had seen it and heard it all a million times over. "He's got a good heart. He doesn't mean it. He promises he'll change." Hell, she was vulnerable to it herself. In the midst of that endless day and night, before they fell asleep and were transported, she'd almost let herself believe, in spite of everything she'd experienced with Frank in the past, that he would do what she asked, that he would get control of his temper. Of course he hadn't. Elaine didn't believe Frank could change. It was his male nature. But he had changed her. Sometimes she thought that Frank had driven her mad. To him, she was the scold, the taskmaster, the grating alarm bell that ended recess each day. It awed her, Frank's obliviousness to the weight of her responsibilities. Did he actually believe it made her happy, having to remind him to pay bills, to pick up things, to keep his temper in check? She was certain that he actually did. Elaine was not blind. She saw that her husband was not a contented man. But he did not see her at all. She had to act for the sake of Nana and all the others. That was what had come into focus that very afternoon, even as Tiffany Jones was dying in that diner, giving up the last of her poor, wrecked life so that a child might live. There would be women who wanted to return. Not a majority. Elaine had to believe most of the women here were not so insane, so masochistic. But could she take that chance? Could she, when her own sweet Nana, who had shrunk into herself every time her father raised his voice? "Stop thinking about it," she told herself. "Concentrate on your business." The red band meant cheap kerosene, and would probably be of no more use to her than the gasoline stored under the town's various service stations. You could douse a lit match in red band kerosene once it was old. But those blue bands meant that a stabilizer had been added, and that kind might retain its volatility for 10 years or more. The tree they'd found that day might be amazing, but it was still a tree, and trees burned. There was the tiger to reckon with, of course, but she would take a gun. Scare it away, shoot it if necessary. She knew how to shoot. Her father had taught her. Part of her thought that might turn out to be a needless precaution. Lila had called the tiger and the fox emissaries, and to Elaine that felt right. She had an idea that the tiger would not try to stop her, that the tree was essentially unguarded. If it was a door, it needed to be closed for good. Someday Nana would understand, and thank her for doing the right thing. 9. Lila did sleep, but woke shortly after 5, with the coming day just a sour line of light on the eastern horizon. She got up and used the chamber pot. Running water had come to Dueling, but it had not yet reached the house on St. George. "A week or two, perhaps," Magda assured them. Lila considered going back to bed, but knew she would only toss and turn and think about how Tiffany, ashy gray at the end, had lost consciousness for the final time with her newborn baby still in her arms. Andrew Jones, whose only legacy would be a stapled-together booklet of handwritten pages. She dressed and left the house. She had no particular destination in mind, but wasn't entirely surprised when she saw the shattered hulk of the municipal building ahead of her. She had spent most of her adult life working there. It was a kind of magnetic north, even though there was nothing there now really to see. A fire of some sort had done the damage, started by a lightning strike, maybe, or faulty wiring. The side of the building that had contained Lila's office was blackened rubble, while years of weather had swept through the broken walls and windows and done its work on the other half, making the drywall soft for mold, blowing in debris that had gathered in layers across the floors. So it surprised Lila to see someone sitting on the granite steps. The steps were about all the old building had going for it anymore. As she drew closer, the figure stood and approached her.
Lila?
Although full of uncertainty and thick with recently shed tears, the voice was familiar.
Lila, is it you?
New women appeared only rarely now, and if this was to be the last, there could be no better. Lila ran to her, embraced her, kissed her on both cheeks.
Linny! Oh, God, it's so good to see you.
Linny Mars hugged her back with panicky force, then held her away so she could look at Lila's face, making sure. Lila understood perfectly and remained still. But Linny was smiling, and the tears on her cheeks were good ones. It felt to Lila as if some divine scale had been balanced. Tiffany's departure on one side, Linny's arrival on the other.
"How long have you been sitting there?" Lila asked at last.
"I don't know," said Linny. "An hour, maybe two. I saw the moon go down. I didn't know where else to go. I was in the office looking at my laptop, and then—" "How did I get here? Where is here?"
"It's complicated," Lila replied. And as she led Linny back to the steps, it occurred to her that this was a thing women said often. Men almost never.
"In a sense, you're still in the office, only in one of the cocoons, or at least that's what we think."
"Are we dead? Ghosts? Is that what you're saying?"
"No, this is a real place."
Lila hadn't been completely sure of this at first, but now she was. Familiarity might or might not breed contempt, but it certainly bred belief.
"How long have you been here?"
"At least 8 months, maybe more. Time moves faster on this side of, well, whatever it is that we're on. I'd guess that over there, where you've come from, it's not even been a full week since Aurora started, right?"
5 days, I think."
Linny sat back down. Lila felt like a woman who has been long abroad and was eager for news of home. "Tell me what's happening in Dueling." Linny squinted at Lila and then gestured at the street.
"But this is Dueling, isn't it? Only it looks kind of cracked up."
"We're working on that," Lila said.
"Tell me what was going on when you left. Have you heard from Clint? Do you know anything about Jared?" That was unlikely, but she had to ask.
"I can't tell you much," Linny said, "because the last 2 days all I could think about was staying awake. I kept taking those drugs in the evidence room, the ones from the Griner Brothers bust, but by the end they were hardly working at all. And there was weird stuff. People coming and going, yelling, somebody new in charge. I think his name was Dave."
"Dave who?"
It was all Lila could do to keep from shaking her dispatcher. Linny frowned down at her hands, concentrating, trying to remember.
"Not Dave," she said at last. "Frank, a big guy. He was wearing a uniform, not a cop's uniform, but then he changed it for a cop's uniform. Frank Gearhart, maybe?"
"Do you mean Frank Geary, the animal control officer?"
"Yes," Linny said. "Geary, that's right. Boy, he's intense. A man on a mission."
Lila didn't know what to make of the Geary news. She remembered interviewing him for the job that had gone to Dan Treeter. Geary had been impressive in person, quick, confident, but his record as an animal control officer had troubled her. He'd been way too free with citations and received too many complaints.
"What about Terry? He's the senior officer. He should have taken my place."
"Drunk," Linny said.
A couple of the other deputies were laughing about it.
What do you... Lenny raised her hand to stop her.
But then right before I fell asleep, some men came in and said Terry wanted the guns from the armament room because of a woman up at the prison. The one who talked to me was that public defender guy. The one you say reminds you of Will Gardner on The Good Wife.
Barry Holden? Lila didn't get it.
The woman up at the prison was undoubtedly Evie Black, and Barry had helped Lila get Evie in a cell at a correctional, but why would he...
Yes, him.
And some others were with him. One was a woman, Warden Coates' daughter, I think.
That can't be, Lila said. She works in D.C.
Well, maybe it was someone else. By then, it was like I was in a deep fog. But I remember Don Peters because of how he tried to feel me up on New Year's Eve last year at the squeaky wheel.
Peters from the prison? He was with Barry?
No, Peters came after. He was furious when he found out some of the guns were gone. They got all the good ones, he said. I remembered that. And there was a kid with him, and that kid said... He said...
Lenny looked at Lila with enormous eyes.
He said, what if they're taking them to Norcross up at the prison? How will we get the bitch out then?
In her mind, Lila pictured a tug-of-war rope, with Evie Black as the knot in the middle that would mean victory for one side or the other.
What else do you remember? Think, Lenny, this is important.
Although what could she, Lila, do about it, even if it was?
Nothing, Lenny said. After Peters and the young guy went running out, I fell asleep and woke up here.
She looked around doubtfully, still not sure that there was a here.
Lila?
Hmm?
Is there anything to eat? I guess I really must not be dead because I'm starving.
Sure, Lila said, helping the other woman to her feet. Scrambled eggs and toast, how's that sound?
Like heaven. I feel like I could eat half a dozen eggs and have room left over for pancakes.
But as it turned out, Lynette Mars never got breakfast. She had, in fact, eaten her last meal the day before, two cherry Pop-Tarts microwaved in the sheriff's station break room. As the two women turned onto St. George Street, Lila felt Lenny's hand melt away in her own. She caught just a glimpse of Lenny from the corner of her eye, looking startled. Then there was nothing left but a cloud of moths rising into the morning sky. Chapter 10 1 There could be no telling, Lowell Griner Sr. used to say, where a deep seam of coal might begin.
Sometimes a single chisel's worth of difference is all there is between the shit and the shinola, was how he put it.
This pearl had dropped from the old crank's lips, around about the time when many of the Tri-County's best miners had been marching through the fucked-up, fucked-over boonies of Southeast Asia, getting jungle rot and smoking heroin-laced fatties. This was a conflict the elder Griner had missed, given a lack of two toes on his right foot and one finger on his left hand. Few men who ever walked the green earth spoke more nonsense than the late Lowell Griner Sr. He had also believed in UFOs, vengeful spirits of the woods, and had taken as gold the empty promises of the coal companies. Big Lowell Griner, he was called, perhaps in honor of that old Jimmy Dean song about Big John. Big Low had rested snug in his coffin for 10 years now, along with a full bottle of Rebel Yell and a pair of lungs that were as black as the bituminate he mined. His son Lowell Jr., naturally known as Little Low, had recalled his father's words with rueful amusement after Sheriff Lila Norcross nipped him and his older brother Maynard with 10 kilos of cocaine, a pharmacy's worth of speed, and all of their guns. It had certainly appeared that the seam of their luck had come to an abrupt end, the shinola magically turning to shit the moment the sheriff's team used the department's bull ram on the kitchen door of the old family manse, a creekside farmhouse for which the term tumble-down was too grand. Though Little Low, who actually stood an inch over 6 feet and weighed in at 240, was not sorry about anything that he had done, he was extremely sorry that it had all not lasted longer. In the weeks that he and Maynard had spent locked up in the county jail in Coughlin, awaiting transfer, he had whiled away most of his free time dreaming on the fun they'd had. The sports cars they'd drag-raced, the fine houses they'd crashed in, the girls they'd screwed, and the numerous slobs they'd stomped. Outsiders who'd tried horning in on the Griner Patch and had ended up buried in the hills. For the better part of 5 years, they'd been serious players up and down the Blue Ridge. It had been a hell of a hot ride, but now it seemed to have turned cold. They were, in fact, fucked in every orifice. The cops had the drugs, had the weapons, had Kitty McDavid to say that she had witnessed Lowell exchanging packets of cash for bundles of coke with their cartel connection on multiple occasions, and that she had seen him shoot that Alabama fool who had tried to pass them counterfeit bills. The cops even had the bump of C4 that they had socked away for the 4th of July. The plan had been to put it under a silo and see if they could get the motherfucker to lift off like one of those Cape Carnival rockets. As good as the ride had been, Lowell wasn't sure how long rerunning the memories could sustain him. Thinking of those memories growing thin and then falling apart was a downer. When they ran out, little Lowell thought he would probably just have to kill himself. He wasn't afraid of that. What he was afraid of was choking on boredom in some cell the way Big Low, confined to a wheelchair and sucking on Yell and bottled oxygen for the last few years of his life, had choked to death on his own snot. Maynard, quarter-wit that he was, would probably be fine for a few decades in prison. That wasn't little Lowell Griner Jr., though. He wasn't interested in playing out a junk hand just to stay in the game. Then, as they were awaiting a pre-trial conference, the shit had turned back into Shinola. God bless Aurora, the vehicle of their deliverance. Said deliverance had arrived last Thursday afternoon, the day the sleeping sickness had come to Appalachia. Lowell and Maynard were shackled to a bench outside a meeting room at the Coughlin courthouse. Both the prosecutor and their lawyer should have arrived an hour earlier. "What the fuck?" announced the prick from the Coughlin Police Department, who was keeping an eye on them. "This is stupid. I don't get paid enough to babysit you murdering Peckerwoods all day. I'm going to see what the judge wants to do." Through the reinforced glass opposite their bench, Lowell could see that Judge Wayner, the only one of the three officials who had seen fit to show up for the hearing, had lowered her head between her arms and dropped off for a little snooze. Neither of the brothers had, at this point, any idea about Aurora, nor had the prick cop.
"Hope she bites his head off for waking her up," Maynard had remarked.
This was not exactly what happened when the horrified officer tore away the mask of webbing that had grown over the Honorable Judge Regina Alberta Wayner's face, but it was, as the saying went, close enough for government work. Lowell and Maynard, chain locked to the bench, saw it all through the reinforced glass. It was awesome. The judge, no more than 5'1" in heels, rose up righteous and smote the cop, say hallelujah, in the chest with a gold-tipped fountain pen. That put the bastard on the carpet, and she pressed the advantage, scooping up her nearby gavel and beating his face in before he had chance to fart sideways or holler, "Your Honor, I object." Then Judge Wayner tossed aside her gory gavel, sat back down again, lowered her head back to her crossed arms, and resumed snoozing.
"Brother, did you see that?" Maynard asked.
"I did."
Maynard had shaken his head, making the unwashed clots of his long hair fly.
"That was amazing. I be dog."
"Court is fucking adjourned," Lowell agreed.
Maynard, firstborn but named for an uncle when his parents felt sure the baby would die before the sun went down on his natal day, had a caveman beard and wide, dull eyes. Even when he was dropping fists on some poor son of a bitch, he tended to look dumbfounded.
"What do we do now?"
What they did was bang around until they broke the arms of the bench they were shackled to and enter the conference room, laying a trail of shattered wood behind them. Careful not to disturb the sleeping Judge Wayner, the webbing was spinning around her head, thickening again, they nicked the cop's keys and unlocked themselves. The brothers also requisitioned the dead prick's gun, his taser, and the keys to his GMC pickup.
"Look at this spider shit,"
Maynard whispered, gesturing at the judge's new coating.
No time, Little Low said.
A door at the end of the hall, opened with the prick's pass card, led to a second hall. As they passed the open door of a staff room, not a single one of the dozen-plus men and women inside, cops, secretaries, lawyers, paid them any mind. They were all focused on News America, where bizarre and horrific footage showed some Amish chick on a table rearing up and biting the nose off a man attending to her. At the end of this second hall was an exit into the parking lot. Lowell and Maynard strolled out into bright sunshine and free air, big as life and happy as hound dogs in a barking contest. The dead cop's GMC was parked nearby, and in the center console was a goodly supply of shit-kicking music. The brothers Griner agreed on Brooks and Dunn, followed by Alan Jackson, who was a good old boy for sure. They boot-scooted their way to a nearby campground and parked the Jimmy Mac behind a forest ranger outpost that had been closed in a round of cutbacks years before. The lock on the outpost door popped with one shove. A woman's uniform hung in the closet. Luckily, she had been a large lady, and at Lowell's command, Maynard squeezed into it. Dressed as such, it was easy to convince the driver of a Chevy Silverado in the campground parking lot to step away for a word.
"Is there something wrong with my camping permit?" Silverado man asked Maynard. "This disease news has got me all turned around, I'll tell you what. I mean, who ever heard of such a thing?"
Then, with a glance at the tag on Maynard's chest, "Say, how'd you get the name Susan?" Little Low gave this question the answer it deserved by stepping out from behind a tree and using a junk of firewood to split Silverado Man's skull. He was approximately Lowell's height and weight. After Low dressed in Silverado Man's clothes, the brothers wrapped the body in a tarp and put it in the back of their new vehicle. They transferred the dead cop's music and drove to a hunting cabin that they had stocked for a rainy day long before. On the way, they burned through the rest of the CDs, agreeing that this James McMurtry fellow was probably a communist, but Hank III was the total package. Once at the cabin, they alternated between the radio and the police scanner they kept there, hoping to glean intelligence concerning the police response to their escape. Initially, Lowell found the complete inattention to said escape unnerving. By the second day, however, the snowballing events of the Aurora phenomenon, which explained the lady judge's rough treatment of the Coughlin cop and the crap on her face, were so encompassing and cataclysmic that Lowell's apprehension evaporated. Who had time for two country outlaws amid mass riots, plane crashes, nuclear meltdowns, and people incinerating chicks in their sleep? 2. On Monday, as Frank Geary was planning his assault on the women's prison, Lowell was reclining on the moldy couch in the hunting cabin, gnawing on deer jerky and visualizing their own next moves. Though the authorities were currently in disarray, they would be reestablished in some form or another before long. Moreover, if things turned out the way they appeared to be headed, those authorities would likely be all rooster, which meant that it would be the Wild West. Hang 'em now, hang 'em high, ask questions later. The Griner brothers wouldn't stay forgotten forever, and when they were remembered, the jackboots would be polished and primed to kick ass. The news on the radio had initially caused Maynard to fall into gloom.
"Is this the end of fucking, Lowell?"
he'd asked. A little blue at the thought himself, Lowe had replied that they'd think of something, as if there might be some alternative. He was thinking of some old song about how birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. His older brother's mood had improved, however, at the discovery of a jigsaw puzzle in a cabinet. Now Maynard, in his camo underwear, on his knees by the coffee table, was drinking a Schlitz and working away on it. The puzzle showed Crazy Cat with his finger in a socket getting electrocuted. Maynard enjoyed puzzles as long as they weren't too hard. This was another reason why Lowell had felt good about his brother's possible prison future. They had a shit ton of puzzles in prison. The picture of Crazy Cat in the center was pretty much done, but the pale green wall surrounding the figure was giving May fits. He complained it all looked the same, which was cheating.
"We need to clean up," Lowell announced.
"I told you," Maynard said. "I put that old boy's head inside a hollow log and dropped the rest of him down a hole."
Lowe's older brother broke down bodies the way other folks broke down turkeys. It was eccentric, but it seemed to bring May satisfaction.
"That's a start, May, but it's not enough. We need to clean up even better while everything is still fucked up. A clean sweep, so to speak."
Maynard finished his beer, pitched the can away.
"How do we do that?"
"We burn down the dueling police station to start with. That'll take care of the evidence," Lowell explained. "That's big numero uno."
His brother's slack-faced expression of puzzlement suggested elaboration was necessary.
"Our drugs, May. They got everything in the bust. We burned those up, they got nothing solid."
Lowell could envision it. Just wonderful. He had never known how much he wanted to obliterate a police station.
"Then just make sure we've got our T's crossed. We'll make a visit to the prison up there and deal with Kitty McDavid."
Lowe sawed a finger across his unshaven neck to show his brother exactly how that deal would go down.
"Oh, she's probably asleep."
Lowe had considered this.
"What if the scientists figure out how to wake them all up?"
"Maybe her memory will be wiped out even if they do. You know, amnesia like on Days of Our Lives."
"And what if it's not, May? When does anything work out as convenient as that? The McDavid cunt can put us away for the rest of our lives. That ain't even the important thing. She snitched. That's the important thing. She needs to go for that. Waking or sleeping."
"You really think we can get to her?" asked Maynard.
In truth, Lowell didn't know, but he thought they had a shot. Fortune favored the brave. He'd seen that in a movie or maybe on a TV show. And what better chance would they have? Practically half the world was asleep, and the rest of it was running around like a chicken with its head cut off.
"Come on, clock's ticking, May. No time like the present. Plus, it'll be dark soon. Always a better time to move around."
"Where do we go first?"
Maynard asked. Lowell didn't hesitate.
"To see Fritz."
Fritz Mischaum had done some engine and detailing work for Lowell Greiner, and had also moved some blow. In exchange, Lowell had connected the Kraut with a few gunrunners. Fritz, besides being a stellar mechanic and an excellent detailer, had a bee in his hat about the federal government, so he was always eager for opportunities to enhance his personal arsenal of heavy weaponry. When the inevitable day came that the FBI decided to capture all of the nation's shanty-dwelling asshole mechanics and ship them off to Guantanamo, Fritz would have to defend himself, and to the death, if need be. Each time Lowell saw him, Fritzy had to show off one cannon or another and brag about how well it could vaporize someone. The hilarious part, it was widely rumored that Fritz had been beaten within an inch of his life by a dog catcher. He was tough, was Lil' Fritz. The last time Lowell had seen him, the bearded gnome had gleefully displayed his latest toy, an actual goddamn bazooka, Russian surplus. Lowe needed to get into the women's prison to assassinate a snitch. That was the sort of mission where a bazooka could actually come in handy. 3. Jared and Gerda Holden had not known each other well. Gerda was in her first year of middle school, and Jared was in high school, but he knew her from dinners when the two families got together. Sometimes they played video games in the basement, and Jared always let her win a couple. A lot of bad had happened since the Aurora outbreak, but this was the first time Jared had seen a person shot.
"She must be dead, right, Dad?" He and Clint were in the bathroom of the administrative wing. Some of Gerda's blood had splattered Jared's face and shirt.
"From the fall on top of the shot?"
"I don't know," Clint said. He was leaning against the tiled wall. His son, patting water from his face with a paper towel, found Clint's eyes in the mirror over the sink.
"Probably," Clint said. "Yes. Based on what you've told me happened, she's almost certainly dead."
"And the guy, too? The doctor? Flickinger?"
"Yes. Him, too, probably."
"All because of this woman? This Evie person?"
"Yes," Clint said.
because of her. We have to keep her safe. From the police and from anyone else. I know it seems crazy. She could be the key to understanding what's happened. The key to turning it around, and just trust me. Okay, Jared?
Okay, Dad. But one of the guards, that Rand guy, he said she's, like, magic?
I can't explain what she is, Jared, he said.
Although he was trying to sound calm, Clint was livid. With himself, with Geary, with Evie. That bullet could have hit Jared. Could have blinded him, left him comatose, killed him. Clint had not beaten up his old friend Jason in the Bertels' yard so that his own son could die before him. He had not shared beds with kids who pissed themselves in their sleep for that. He had not left behind Marcus and Shannon and all the others for that, and he had not worked his way through college or medical school for it. Shannon had told him all those years before that if he just hung on and kept from killing anyone, he would make it out. But to make it out of the current situation, they might have to kill people. He might have to kill people. The idea did not upset Clint as much as he would have expected. The situation changed and the prizes changed, but maybe, at bottom, it was the same deal. If you wanted the milkshake, you'd better be ready to fight.
What? Asked Jared. Clint cocked his head. You look, his son said, sort of tense.
Just tired. He touched Jared's shoulder and excused himself. He needed to make sure everyone was placed. 4. There was no need to say, I told you so. Terry caught Frank's eye as they stepped away from the group around the bodies.
You were right, Terry said.
He produced the flask. Frank thought about stopping him, didn't. The acting sheriff took a healthy swallow.
You were right all the way down the line. We'll have to take her.
You sure? Frank said it as if he himself wasn't.
Are you kidding? Look at this goddamn mess. Vern dead. Girl there did it. She's shot to pieces and dead too. Lawyer's skull caved in. Think he might have lived for a while, but he's sure dead now. Other guy, driver's license says he's an M.D. named Flickinger.
Him too, really?
If so, it was too bad. Flickinger had been a mess, but he'd had enough soul left in him to try to help Nana.
And that's not the worst part. Norcross and the black woman and the rest of them have got serious armaments now. Most everything high-powered that we could have used to make them stand down.
Do we know who was with them? Frank asked. Who was behind the wheel of that RV when they hauled ass out of here?
Terry tipped the flask again, but there was nothing left inside. He swore and kicked a chunk of broken McAdam. Frank waited.
Codger named Willie Burke.
Terry Coombs breathed out between his teeth.
Cleaned up his act in the last 15 or 20 years. Does a lot of community stuff, but he's still a poacher. Used to be a moonshiner, too, back when he was young. Maybe he still is.
Vet. Can handle himself.
Lyle always gave him the right of way, felt like it wouldn't be worth the trouble to try and get him for something.
And I guess she liked him. He inhaled.
I felt the same.
All right. Frank had decided to keep Black's phone call to himself. It had infuriated him so much, in fact, that he would have been hard-pressed to recount the details of the conversation. One part had stayed with him, though, and tugged at his sleeve. How the woman had praised him for protecting his daughter at the hospital. How could she have known about that? Eve Black had been in the jail that morning. It kept coming back to him, and he kept pushing it away. As with the moths that had burst from the lit fragment of Nana's cocoon, Frank could not fathom an explanation. He could only see that Eve Black had meant to tweak him, and she had succeeded. But he didn't believe she understood what tweaking him meant. In any case, Terry was back on track. He didn't need any extra motivation.
You want me to start putting together a group? I'm willing, if that's your pleasure.
Although pleasure had nothing to do with it, Terry seconded the motion. 5. The prison defenders hurriedly removed the tires from the various cars and trucks in the parking lot. There were about 40 vehicles altogether, counting the prison vans. Billy Wettermore and Rand Quigley rolled the tires out and arranged them in pyramids of three in the dead space between the inner and outer fences, then doused them in gasoline. The petrol stench quickly overwhelmed the ambient odor of damp, charred wood from the still-smoldering fire in the woods. They left the tires on Scott Hughes's truck, but parked at Crossways right behind the interior gate as an extra barrier.
"Scott loves that truck," Rand said to Tig.
"You want to put yours there instead?"
Tig asked.
"Hell no," said Rand. "Are you crazy?"
The only vehicle they left untouched was Barry Holden's RV, situated in the handicap space by the cement path to the intake doors. 6. Minus Vern Rangel, Roger Elway, and the department's female officers, all of whom had been confirmed as asleep during Frank's cataloging operation, 7 deputies remained from Chief Lila Norcross's duty roster. Terry Coombs, Pete Ordway, Elmore Pearl, Dan Treater Treat, Roop Whitstock, Will Whitstock, and Reed Barrows. It was a solid group, in Terry's opinion. They were all force veterans of at least a year, and Pearl and Treater had both served in Afghanistan. The 3 retired deputies, Jack Albertson, Mick Napolitano, and Nate McGee, made 10. Don Peters, Eric Blass, and Frank Geary made lucky 13. Frank quickly marshaled a half-dozen other volunteers, including Coach J.T. Whitstock, father of the deputies who shared his surname, and the Defense First coach of the dueling high school varsity football team. Pudge Marone, bartender at the Squeaky Wheel, who brought along his Remington shotgun from beneath the bar. Drew T. Berry of Drew T. Berry Indemnity Company, by-the-book insurance agent and prize-winning deer hunter. Carson Country Strong Struthers, Pudge's brother-in-law, who had fought to a 10-1 Golden Gloves record before his doctor told him he had to quit while he still had some brain left, and 2 town board members, Bert Miller and Steve Pickering, both of whom, like Drew T. Berry, knew their way around a deer stand. That was 19, and once they were informed that the woman inside the prison might have information related to the sleeping sickness, maybe even knowledge of a cure, every single one was eager to serve. 7. Terry was pleased, but wanted an even 20. The sight of Vern Rangel's bleached-out face and torn neck was something he would never be able to forget. He could feel it the way he could feel Geary, silent as a shadow, following everything he did, judging every choice he made. But never mind. The only way out was through. Through Norcross to Eve Black, and through the black woman to the end of this nightmare. Terry didn't know what would happen when they got to her, but he knew it would be the end. Once the end came, he could work at blurring the memory of Vern Rangel's bloodless face, not to mention the faces of his wife and daughter, which no longer exactly existed. Seriously drinking his brain into submission, in other words. He was aware that Frank had been encouraging him to use the booze, and so what? So fucking what? Don Peters had been tasked with calling around to the male officers on dueling correctional's roll, and it didn't take him long to figure out that Norcross had 4 officers on duty, max. One of those, Wettermore, was a swish, and another, Murphy, had been a history teacher. Throw in the black woman and the old coot, Burke, plus maybe a couple or 3 others they didn't know about just to be generous, and that meant they were up against less than a dozen. Few, if any, of whom could be expected to stand fast if things got hot, no matter how much armament they had acquired. Terry and Frank stopped at the liquor store on Main Street. It was open and busy.
"She didn't love me anyway,"
one fool announced to the entire store, waving a bottle of gin. He smelled like a polecat. The shelves were largely empty. But Terry found 2 pints of gin, and paid with money that would soon be worthless, he supposed, if this terrible fuck-up went on. He filled the flask with 1 pint, carried the other in a paper bag, and walked with Frank to a nearby alley. It opened into a courtyard piled with garbage bags and rain-softened cardboard boxes. Johnny Lee Kronsky's scuffed apartment door was here, at ground level, between 2 windows with plastic sheeting for glass. Kronsky, a mythic figure in this part of West Virginia, answered and spied the bottle in the bag. "Those who come bearing gifts may enter," he said, and took the bottle. There was only one